I remember thinking when I went to the Pinaha that these were people who would be afraid of spirits, afraid of the jungle around them, and that they would be very open to hearing about Jesus, who gave his life so they could be happy, and learning about him and his word as I conceptualized things at that time. I got there excited, but it didn't take me very long to know and to observe that they really weren't interested in Jesus.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. In this week's episode, using Jesus as bait when the fish just aren't that hungry, opening your mind to cultural, moral relativism, and using Satan to battle hypocrisy in government. All coming up next. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett.
And I'm Peggy Knutson.
How are you, Peggy Knutson?
I am doing great. How are you, Bo?
Doing excellent. So what do you have planned for the new year? Do you have a whole list of things to do? Do you have goals? What do you do?
You know what? I'm not much for making New Year's resolutions. If I do, I just try to do something for someone and try and make a difference, try and volunteer a little bit more, or help someone when I can instead of give up or lose weight or all of those things.
Well, that's good. Well, you don't need to lose weight, so you're fine.
Okay, get healthy, exercise more.
I always, one of the lectures I give is on New Year's resolutions, and I really have a beef with people calling resolutions like things like little goals that they want to do that they kind of have written down in pencil. It's like, no, the whole concept of resolution, the word is resolute. It's you are committed to something, you're going to do it. And considering that 50% of the people give up their resolutions after, I don't know, what was a week or something, or by February 1st, and then it's like 90% after that, that's just not a resolution. If you're going to make a resolution, you do it.
I'm guilty of that, totally.
Well, there's if you're going to call it a resolution, yeah, then you got to do it. Otherwise, just call it, you know, here are some things that I'd like to do, and I'd like to do for the new year, and just be honest with yourself.
I'm going to call you Yoda. It's do or do not. There is no try.
That's right. Good advice from the little green guy.
There's my geekdom coming through full force. Haha.
Nice. So who are we talking to today?
Today is Daniel Everett. He is a linguist and a professor from Bentley University, and he has written a book called Don't Sleep, There Are Snakes, about his life in the Amazon jungle with the Pinaha tribe.
All right, let's get him on the line. And Peggy and I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Daniel Everett. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
We're doing great. Doing great.
Great. Thanks.
Well, Peggy read your book.
Don't Sleep, There Are Snakes.
Don't Sleep, There... What an interesting title. And she told me, she said, we got to get this guy on the Humanist Hour. He's got an amazing story to tell. She was fascinated with the book. I said, all right, you have me sold, after she explained your story for the first 30 seconds. So Dan, before we get too deep into it, why don't you just give us a little bit of a background of yourself and who you are and what you currently do?
Okay. I was born in Southern California. Raised in a very typical blue-collar family. My mother was a waitress, and my father was a mechanic slash cowboy slash truck driver. I was very interested in becoming a musician until the time I was about 17. I was get involved in lots of things that happened in San Diego in the 60s, and music and light drugs, nothing heavy, just a little acid and marijuana for a while. And then I got involved with a Christian family. They were back from Brazil, where they were missionaries. And I was always interested in exotic places, though I had never been to one. And I met a fellow who had a magazine in Portuguese, and I asked him where he got it. And this was at high school in San Diego, and he said, my parents are missionaries in Brazil. And it just sounded surreal to have parents that were missionaries that lived in the jungle. So I was fascinated and started talking to him, and found out that he had a sister. And we started talking, and I would visit the home, and his sister talked to me a lot about Christianity, and his father certainly did as well. And coming from the background that I came from, that sounded fascinating to me. So I became a believer, started going to church regularly, and as we used to say, dedicated my life to the missionary calling. And eventually went to college at Moody Bible Institute, where I graduated number one in my class in 1975. And then we went to, eventually finished our missionary training and went to Brazil, where we were assigned to a group called the Pitahá. And the reason we were assigned there is because we had done well, my wife and I both, in linguistics, and they figured that since no one else had been able to really analyze the grammar of this language, that perhaps we would be willing to take on the challenge. And I said yes, and that was the beginning of my real conversion and my real change of life. And it was just a profound experience that went over a period of about 30 years, with actually 8 years living in the jungle. And I remember thinking when I went to the Pitahá that these were people who would be afraid of spirits, afraid of the jungle around them, and that they would be very open to hearing about Jesus, who gave their his life so they could be happy, and learning about him in his word, as I conceptualized things at that time. And I got there excited, but it didn't take me very long to know and to observe that they really weren't interested in Jesus. In fact, we didn't share many assumptions at all, like I thought we did. They didn't have a concept of sin. They didn't have a concept of punishment. They didn't even have a concept of God. Mm-hmm. I asked them once, who created the world? And they said, what do you mean? I said, well, you know, who did the Pitahá say created the world? Like what? Give me, you know. I said, well, you know, the trees. When they weren't here, who made the trees? They said, you were here at the jungle at a time when there were no trees? No, I wasn't. But how do you know there were no trees? Well, there was nothing, and then something came. They said, no, we don't talk like that. We say everything is always the same. It's always been this way. And on and on. And every time I thought I would have an end, I had been reading Christian theology that suggested that every culture was somehow prepared to hear the gospel message. They would have some point of contact. Mm. But I couldn't find much point of contact. In fact, the one thing I thought I had to deliver to people was absence of fear and a way to live the good life, but they were afraid of nothing, and I couldn't imagine a life better than theirs. Now, I have to temper that, because a lot of times people say you're glorifying the native, you're going native, but I say this after careful observation, and I've worked with over a dozen groups in the Amazon I've done field work with, and I've worked with groups in Mexico and in North America, indigenous peoples, and I certainly have never found a group of people that in which superstition was so absent, and in which they took a very empirical view of the world. And you know, I said there's no concept of sin, but there are things that are better to avoid, and one of those is anger. The concept of anger for the Pitahá is a difficult, I mean, they understand what it is to be angry, but to display anger towards others is just not something that is done. So every day when I would get up and do my work on this language, I was impressed with the stories they told me, which were always stories of things they had experienced, and I was impressed with their psychological strength and their outlook of optimism on the world. I mean, if you every pitahaya is able to feed and take care of themselves once they get to be about 9 years of age. And so every pitahaya, man and woman, is at peace with their environment because they know that they're capable of finding food, they're capable of making a place to live, and they have everything they need. And these things were very profound to me. They affected me tremendously. So I would leave the village for a while and go back to the missionary compound, and people would say, how many converts do you have? Well, in fact, in the years that preceded me with the other missionaries that had lived among the Pitahaya, we were the third family. There had been no converts, from 1959 to the time we got there in 1977. And in the last 38 years now, since 1977, there have been no converts.
Maybe it's, one convert?
Well, there was one convert that some people, my ex-wife, for example, talks about. But it's not at all clear that that this person either understands the gospel or really wants it. I mean, it's a lot of converts I found as I began to look at missionaries from a more objective and scientific standpoint come to the missionary because the missionary is the source of all trade goods, the source of education, the source of trips to the outside world. One's life can improve dramatically if one pleases the missionary. And there's no greater way to please a missionary than to say that you're a Christian.
Well, I was referring to you.
Oh, right. I missed that, of course. I am the convert. That's right. There was one convert, and it went in the opposite direction.
You turned it on its head.
I really began to question my life and the things that had led me to go there. And realized that not only did I have nothing of any significance to offer them, but that they, in fact, had a lot to offer me. Mm. They were and have always been understanding of me when I've been there by myself and they're worried about me being lonely, when I am there with my family and someone's sick. And I began to really question the fundamentals of my faith. And some of the questions they asked me that were really provocative were, I was telling them a story about Jesus, and there were several men sitting around with some women in the background, and the men said, so Dan, is Jesus brown like us or is he white like you? And I said, well, some people say he was brown and some people say he was white. They said, but you know, you've seen him. And I said, well, I haven't actually seen Jesus. I've only seen pictures of him. And they said, but your father saw him. And I said, no, my father didn't see him. They said, well, who do you know that saw him? And I said, well, I don't know anybody that saw him. And they were just astounded that I would waste their time telling them a story about something that I had no empirical evidence for.
Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett. I'm here with Peggy Knutson, and we're speaking with Dr. Daniel Everett.
And when I say empirical evidence, when they talk about empirical evidence, they're not simply talking about me giving them answers to prayer or something like that, because those are also intangible things. They want to see really concrete physical evidence of something that you're talking about, and I was unable to provide that. Another time I was telling them the story of my stepmother who committed suicide, and it was a very moving story to me, and it had a lot to do with my Christianity at one point, and it usually affected American audiences. You know, they would be really moved by the story. So I translated the story into Pitahaya. I told the Pitahaya about this suicide, and they started laughing.
Wow.
And this was not the reaction I expected. And when I asked them, why are you laughing, they said, you people kill yourselves? This is really, Pitahaya don't kill themselves. They thought I was joking. They couldn't believe that there was a society in which people actually killed themselves.
Huh.
And I realized that I was, as they told me that, I began to think about evidence for depression among the group, and I realized I didn't know what it would be like to actually see a depressed Pitahaya. I've seen them sad and I've seen them hurt, physically, and I've seen them ill, but I've never had anyone with symptoms of depression. You know, life goes on, they have to take care of things, and then I realized that they don't talk about the distant future, and they don't talk about the distant past. They talk about only those things that they have experienced themselves, or which are they're pretty sure are going to be similar to today. So they might say, tomorrow I'm going to go fish upriver, and then another day I will fish downriver. But that's really about all they'll say about the future, because you have no evidence for the future. And you have no evidence for the past unless you've seen it yourself or it's been told to you by someone else. And I found this a very fascinating way to conceive of the world. They're extremely intelligent people. They think about the world as deeply as anyone I've ever met. And yet at the same time, they don't believe it makes much sense to ask to talk about things they don't know or haven't experienced. I mean, they might ask me, they can see satellites in the sky. In the Amazon, things are so clear in the night sky. Sure. And they've pointed out satellites to me and asked, you know, what is that? And I tell them it's like a little radio thing that somebody put up there. And they're willing to accept that that explanation. They assume that I've seen them, and I, you know, seen them on television. Or they'll ask me about the moon and say, has an American ever been to the moon? And because we do so many weird things. And I tell them, yes, Americans have been on the moon. And they say, is it hot? And I say, no, it's not hot. They said, it looks hot, but it's not hot. No, it's not hot. And they accept these answers. They're moderately curious, but they're not overwhelmed by the things they don't know in the world that they can't do much about. And I do think that this is has a lot to do with their lack of depression, their lack of regret about past deeds, certainly about their past history, because nobody talks about past history. Hmm. There's no myth of creation. There's no story about God. There's no fear of evil spirits. It's just a fascinating culture in many ways that violates our expectations of what cultures are like.
Well, Dan, I got a whole bunch of questions for you. That was a great introduction, so I got to start rambling these off. First question is, has your father been to the moon?
No, he has not been to the moon.
Who do you know that's been to the moon?
I don't know anyone who's been to the moon.
I
am speculating here that the television accounts are correct, but that wouldn't pass muster among the Pitahā.
Okay. And about how many Pitahā are there?
When I first started working there, there were about 130 or so, and now they're up to close to 800.
Wow. What accounts for that huge shift?
Well, we did medical work for the first several years. We were the only medical assistants they had, and ours was pretty basic because none of us, I certainly don't have, and neither did my wife, significant training in medicine, just first aid stuff. But now the Brazilian government over the last 10 to 15 years has been going up there regularly, vaccinating against measles and against a variety of common diseases out in that area, and treating people for diseases if they happen to be sick when they get there.
Okay. Because when you were talking about depression, and it just, you couldn't see it really among that group. 130, that would make sense, I guess. I mean, it's not statistically impossible that nobody would suffer from any kind of biological, psychological diseases with a group of 130 or something like that.
That's always the case. When you're talking about small groups like this, you have But even more profound than that, when you claim that something is not there, mm-hmm. That's a lot harder to prove wrong than if you claim that you've seen it.
Yeah.
So heard that before.
You're exactly right. The fact that I never observed depression may be statistically insignificant.
Right. Well, it's just interesting, the number of people. And what denomination of Christianity were you? You sounded very much like a Mormon.
But you know, there's not that much difference at times between the denominations, even though they fight about that. I was an ordained minister in the Wesleyan Methodist Church.
Okay. All right.
Very evangelical.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. And it's interesting that, have you heard the phrase before, the God-shaped hole in the heart? Everybody has a God-shaped hole in their heart.
Yes, I've heard about
Apparently, this group of people do not have that hole.
Yeah, that's false. No, that's actually, the God-shaped hole in the heart is false. That's an interesting idea, but I know now that there are entire peoples that do not have that God-shaped hole in their heart.
Wow.
Is this the only culture that you are aware of that really has no mythology or creation myths?
Yeah, among the many controversial claims that I've published about the group, many of which are being, I mean, they're all being tested on a regular basis. That was one I was surprised at how controversial it was to claim that they were a group that lacked mythology in the sense of fiction and creation stories and that sort of thing. And I don't know of another group that lacks that. But it is striking about them.
So in their language, do they use a past tense?
No, there is no past tense or future tense in Pitahan. Mm-hmm. Their verbs are very complicated. You know, if you think about English, we have five possible forms for every verb: sing, sang, sung, singing, sings. But in Pitahan, there are as many as 65,000 or more forms for every verb. But ironically, those don't include some of the common verb things we use in English. So there's no tense.
Can you explain? Do you think that the language came before the cultural value, or did the cultural value inform the language as far as not having mythology and not believing something unless they have experienced it?
Well, in my book, Language, the Cultural Tool, I argue that that these two things develop together, but there are points at which one culture or language can dramatically affect the other. And in the case of Pitahan, this principle of what I call immediacy of experience, some of the things I've just described, no past, talking about the distant past or distant future, no color words, no number words are the only group known that lacks numbers. And their grammar is very different than the grammar of many of all other languages we really know about. So I've argued that this immediacy of experience has dramatically affected the grammar and the different words that they have and don't have.
One thing I found so fascinating in the book was your description of their dream state, and that they felt like that was actually a separate life, or it was actually happening to them, whatever happened in their dreams.
Yes, they see what goes on in their brain. If they believe they're seeing it, then it's real. And if it's a dream, they see that as a separate, a different kind of reality, a distinct form of experience. So it's quite common for a Pitahan in the middle of the night when everybody's snoring to sit right up and start singing their dream. And I've had this happen more than once. It's kind of disquieting a little bit at first, because you know you're sleeping and then suddenly this person, and they sleep all around us. You know, we used a bed for the first few years, and I would get up and there would be legs sticking out from under the bed and people all around the bed, and then I started using a hammock and they would be right under my hammock. And so then somebody decides to sit right up by you like that and start telling about your dream. But to them, why wouldn't you talk about it? It's the same as talking about what you saw when you went fishing. Also, since nobody has a schedule to keep, why not talk at night as soon as it happens?
Hmm. That does sound superstitious, though. The thought that dreams are reality or exist in some other dimension or realm, you hear a lot of superstitious people say something like that, don't you?
Well, they don't claim that the dreams give them direction about, you know, so they're not seeing visions of spiritual entities. If somebody's dreaming, he's dreaming that he was hunting, or he's dreaming that he was fishing, or he's dreaming that he actually went up above the clouds and saw the sky. It's different perspectives on natural experience. So the question of what superstition is interesting. I mean, they don't have any entities that tell them what to do. They're not afraid of black cats. You don't see them doing things for good luck or against bad luck. But at the same time, what we call fiction, fact versus fiction, is very often a cultural boundary. So, you know, if you go into the churches of Pentecostals who say that they're speaking in tongues, to them that is reality. I wouldn't call that necessarily superstition. They make superstitious claims about it, but I would call it just confusion to think that, you know, from my perspective, as a linguist, I can write down tongues that people are speaking in and show them why this is not actually a language. It's just babbling. So the dividing line between fact and fiction is different for different cultures. You know, you gave the example of going to the moon. I mean, how do we really know that anybody went to the moon? How do we really know that some of the things we see in the news are being reported? Because we take those accounts, not even firsthand, third and fourth hand, and we say, well, that's right, that's true. Whereas for the Pitaha, that would be a sort of blurring of the fact-fiction distinction, because fiction, fact, is what you experience, not what somebody tells you necessarily.
Right, right. You know, Dan, in all this talk of the magical thinking, I'm thinking about the research in this area that shows people who belong to cultures that tend to experience a lot of hardships tend to be more prone to magical thinking. And I was wondering if the Pitaha fit that description. And from what you're telling me, I don't know if they do. They seem to be pretty self-sustained. So I guess my ultimate question on this is the idea of prosperity. Would you consider the Pitaha a prosperous group? And if so, that would seem to make sense in this area of magical thinking research. However, if they were not a very prosperous group and they did experience a lot of natural disasters, then this really doesn't make sense.
They are prosperous in a cultural sense. They meet all their own needs. They have no natural disasters. They do have occasional, I mean, they have malaria from time to time and some other diseases. But the concept of poverty is a cultural concept in the sense that if you have no one else to compare yourself with, you probably don't feel poor as long as you have shelter and food that's sufficient. So in that sense, the Pitaha would describe themselves as having what they need. Now, the interesting thing is, as they've had more and more contact over the last 10 years, because different governmental groups have started making regular contact that are somewhat disruptive, the Pitaha have begun to learn more Portuguese, and they have begun to decide that they don't have enough, because the government went in and gave them a lot of food for free. They did nothing for this food, and they got used to being given rice. Mm. And when the government doesn't go in and they don't get the rice, now they feel hungry and they begin to feel poor compared to others. And so up until now, there's no magical thinking in the Pitaha. No Pitaha thinks they have the power to do action at a distance, to curse you or to bless you or to levitate things. You just never hear talk of anything like magic among the Pitaha. But I suppose it's possible over the years, if the culture changes, that would come along.
Dan, there might be some people that would find some of the descriptions in the book a little disturbing. The life in the Amazon is quite harsh, and the Pitaha seem to definitely, there's sort of a survival of the fittest mentality for the group. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. You know, the Pitaha, you know, life is hard. You have to be able to take care of yourself. People will help, but nobody is responsible for anybody else. So just as nobody tells you what to do, nobody's responsible for you either. So there was a time where a young mother got very sick and she died, and I still don't know what she died of. And her baby was not really sick, but her baby was not malnourished. No one else was nursing the baby. So I worked out an ingenious system using some squeeze bottles that I had to feed the baby milk. And as the baby was making progress, and I was I was happy about this. But the people said, oh, she's hurting. She's in a lot of pain. And I said, well, she's hungry, and we have to take care of her, and she'll get better. And I continued to work around the clock on the baby, hadn't had sleep for days. So finally, my wife and I took a walk out on our airstrip, and which was one of the conveniences of being a missionary. And when we got back to the house, I smelled alcohol very strongly, and the baby was dead. I had given the baby to another Pinaha woman to watch for us while we took a walk. And I said, what happened? And they said, well, the baby died. And I said, did anybody give it alcohol? They said the baby was hurting and suffering. It needed to die. So that was very hard for me to take. But at the same time, the Pinaha might have been better at diagnostics than me. They've seen a lot of people die, and they knew the baby was suffering, and they disagreed with my intervention. And they knew there was nobody there to take care of the baby. So I'm not defending infanticide, but to say that I don't want to pronounce judgment on what they did. I think that they were doing what they thought was the most appropriate thing to do for a baby that was terminally ill. I don't know that the baby was terminally ill, but yes, life is very difficult in the Amazon, and people's life expectancy are not like they are here. You know, one of the things about us is when we get sick, we almost feel like it's our right to keep living. We go to the doctor and we, you know, no matter how old we are, no matter how sick we are, we throw this responsibility to keep us alive on the doctor, sometimes with unrealistic expectations. And the Pinaha don't see it as this right to live. You know, you live a short period of time. You may live longer, but you take one day at a time. And when the suffering gets too great, nobody takes their own life. And this is the only time I know of that they've ever taken a child's life. But you know, life is difficult, and I have never been in a situation as they've been in to evaluate this.
Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett. I'm here with Peggy Knutson, and we're speaking with Dr. Daniel Everett. Hey, Dan, that's kind of a broader question, this whole idea of cultural diversity. I imagine that a lot of people here in the United States who lack cultural diversity have a very, I guess, rigid view of morality based on their own culture, and people who aren't exposed to all these other cultures, it's just very difficult to understand these different moral dilemmas. Have you found that by experiencing all these different cultures firsthand, that your sense of morality changed?
Definitely. My sense of morality has changed dramatically by seeing things that are, you know, that horrify, say, North Americans, but Amazonian groups might not even bat an eye. And I've just finished a book on this called The Culturally Articulated Unconscious, which is how we absorb these things from our own personal experiences and construct our own value systems based on the experiences, both psychological and cultural, we've had. But you take, for example, pedophilia. You know, in this country, I'm speaking absolutely non-judgmentally. In this country, it's a terrible crime to have sexual relations with anybody who's below 18. Whereas in the Amazon, whether you're Brazilian or you're Pinaha or any other indigenous group, there's absolutely no reason that you wouldn't have, you know, children see sex all around them. There's very little privacy compared to what we have. I suspect that a lot of children get sexually active before before puberty sets in. And you see people who are 30 or 40 or 50 in relationships with people who are 10 or 11 or 12. And for us, that is a horrible wrong. But for them, they don't see what's so bad about it. And I'm not saying that my morality has changed to accept the latter practice, but instead what I see is that we can't be too sure that what we're saying is wrong is always wrong. This gets into moral relativity, which of course has a long, long history. But I will say that I have become more aware of alternative moralities because of these experiences.
Yeah.
And did that lead to your deconversion, I suppose, or the other way around?
It played a large role. So the things that led to my deconversion were Peter Hahn's sense of everything has to be empirical, their own happiness and contentment, their ability to deal with the world around them, my contact with Brazilians, where they had a much more open view of the world than the American Christians that had sent me out and that I had spent my teenage and early adult years as one of. So there were a number of things that led to this. And at some point, I remember one very clear case where I was translating the Gospel of Luke, and I was reading the begets, the genealogical section to a Peter Hahn. And he was being so kind because these were names he had never heard, but he assumed they were friends of mine. And so he would try to come up with a way of saying this in Peter Hahn and totally believing that I was being, I was talking from experience about something that was, directly relevant, not just in the spiritual sense, but enough, these were people I knew.
Yeah.
And then we showed them a film strip of the crucifixion and Jesus dying and resurrecting. And I told them all about this. And it just made no sense to them whatsoever. And I'm thinking, these wonderful, sweet people are doing their very best to understand and be good sports and believe what I'm telling them. And yet, by their standards, I don't have a shred of evidence for anything that I'm saying. And that tremendously challenged me. And in fact, it produced an ethical dilemma that, who am I to tell them this stuff when I'm so in violation of their own standards of reason? And eventually, when you're a missionary, if you announce that you're no longer a believer, you're unemployed. But I struggled with this for a while until I realized that I could not play the game anymore. I could not pretend to feel something or believe something that just made no sense in light of these experiences and the world around me. And it was extremely liberating, but at the same time, I think in a way it must be like somebody coming out about their sexual orientation or something, because I had a lot of friends, hundreds of people who gave money to our work, who wrote me on a regular basis. Most of them don't, I can only think of one who will still talk to me. And the others, in fact, I've gotten quite a few nasty messages from former Christian friends.
Wow. It's fascinating to me, the drive for missionaries to go into different cultures and tell the people there is something wrong with them that needs to be fixed.
That's exactly right. That captures it very well. As my personal evangelism teacher told me in my early Christianity, you got to get them lost before you get them saved. Right. They've got to feel lost before they need a savior. So you got to let them know they're going to hell.
Right.
And first get them to believe that they're going to hell. And once they get, then you can tell them about heaven.
Right.
Or it wasn't really possible with the Pitaha to get them lost.
No, they were totally unaffected. There's, they would ask me all kinds of questions, and it was like I was being interrogated by Martian anthropologists. They were just so fascinated by, you guys believe this. Interest, they just found it utterly fascinating.
Yeah, another way to say that is convince them they're diseased and then sell them the cure, but they just weren't buying the disease.
Exactly. They say, well, no, actually, we feel quite fine. We're not needing any medicine right now. And that was another eye-opener to me, that because it's against what most Christians are taught in church, that there's a group of people who can actually hear and understand the gospel. Now, my ex-wife had a very different experience. Her view is that you have to try harder. So she still lives there with them trying to convert them. Mm-hmm. And I've told her, I said, you're going to have a long, lonely existence if you keep pushing ahead with that agenda.
Wow. When you were talking about your story of deconversion, it sounded like a lot of times people will deconvert because of some like reason or some logic, or they started to investigate the evidence and so forth. But in your case, it sounds like you realized first that this need for Christianity wasn't as great as you thought it was, and people can be good people and live good lives without it. And was it that perhaps that need that wasn't as strong as you thought led you to look at the evidence more carefully, be more critical of it?
Yeah, I think that's a good summary. I learned to love the Peter Hahn to count it as one of my greatest privileges to be their friend and to have them as my friends. And I just couldn't say that these people were lost. I couldn't admit that. I couldn't find any part of me that was willing to accept the idea that these were lost people going to hell. Mm. And then the absurdity of my position really stood out to me, as it had never done. And as, you know, I was pretty good at apologetics and making a case against the unbelievers of the world. But this was something that apologetics had never prepared me for, and it opened the way to a new perspective and a new thinking about religion once I found people like this. And I know they're not the only people. They just happen to be the people that that had this effect on me.
It sounds to me, Dan, like your story would make a marvelous film.
Yeah.
Essential Media of Australia, who produced the film Saving Mr. Banks with Disney, has actually acquired the rights to a film about Don't Sleep, There Are Snakes. And there is a play premiering in London at the end of March called Don't Sleep, There Are Snakes, which I will be at and see how they treat my life in the play. It's been a tremendous privilege of mine to be with the Peter Hahn. And the things that I have that others find interesting are really the gifts of the Peter Hahn, the marvelous privilege and experience that I've had. My son now is an anthropologist at the University of Miami, and his journey was not the same as mine, but he agrees with me about religion and atheism. And yet at one time he was my believing boy who would speak at churches from the time he was 8 years of age. And now we can talk about that together. And it's really uplifting and rewarding to have someone in the family who's made a similar journey, who's reached the same conclusions.
I bet his mother doesn't like that too much.
No, but he's a wonderful son, and he doesn't talk to her about it. It's his mom, and he doesn't take it as one of the most important responsibilities in his life to disabuse her of the ideas that have motivated her entire life.
Yeah, good for him. Your play that you were talking about and the movie that this could be made into a movie, it reminds me a lot of, there are a lot of similarities with the Book of Mormon, the play. I don't know if you've seen that.
I haven't seen it, but I have read a lot about it, watched clips on YouTube, and have heard from people who've been there that it's just great.
It is great. It's a wonderful play. The overall plot is very similar to yours. We have these missionaries that go down to this tribe to try to change them, but they realize they can't change them, so they have to adapt a little bit. I won't give away the plot. Your story seems to have a lot less foul language, and it's not as musical, but it still sounds good.
Yeah, well, I have a very good friend who was dean at the University of Pittsburgh. He's a specialist in medieval English literature and American Indianist literature, and he was a Mormon missionary and who's now an atheist. And we've had a lot of many lunches together, talking and laughing about our missionary experiences.
Yeah. That's great. You said you had a book coming out. I think you may have two books coming out. Is that correct?
The book that is coming out next year is called The Dark Matter of the Mind, The Culturally Articulated Unconscious. That's for the University of Chicago Press. And then I'm hoping to finish up in the next 5 months a book called How Language Began, which is on the evolution of human language. And I'm teaching a course next semester on human evolution.
I'm not sure how you have time to teach.
Well, I just found that I was missing it so badly. You know, most of us who got into academics really didn't understand much about research. What we knew was we had good teachers and we wanted to share that experience with others. We wanted to be a good teacher, and we get sidetracked in other things. But for me, the whole joy of being an academic is teaching.
That's great. So, Dan, where can people find out information about you and your books?
You can go to my website, daneverettbooks.org.
Dan, this has been great. What an interesting story, and I'm really looking forward to reading that book. And you said one of your books is about morality?
The book, Dark Matter of the Mind, is how the culturally articulated unconscious. One of the themes of that book is how we acquire our value systems, our morality, and a lot of other values that fall outside of morality, perhaps, such as you should wear a tie to work or something like that. So how do we acquire these things, and how do we rank them? That's another important thing. So I've said about terrorism, it's ranking the belief in truth with a capital T over human life. Yeah. So that book is about ranking values.
Wow, that sounds fascinating. All right, Dan. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to be on with us. This was great.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you very much for having me.
So what do you think of the conversation, Peggy?
Just great. I was so glad to get to speak with him since I had read his book, and it was wonderful.
Right. And it was funny, too, because at the beginning, before we recorded, I told him, I said, you got a wonderful story. Just go ahead and start telling it. Even if it's going to take the whole interview, just start telling your story. And I realized that was a mistake, because as he was talking, I was frantically jotting down all these questions because he was saying such interesting things. I had like a page of questions and I had to say, okay, wait a minute. But I only got
time
to a few
for
of them.
Some questions,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. So that was great. A very interesting guy. And I'm really looking forward to reading his book, the one that deals with morality and values. I think from a cultural perspective, I think that's fascinating. And that's something that a lot of people overlook when they're talking about morality.
Yeah, that one is Dark Matter of the Mind. It's coming out in 2016.
All right, we have a little time left. So let's play a quick interview that Kim Ellington did with Lucian Greaves.
So I'm at the Atheist Alliance of America conference, and I'm here with Lucian Greaves, who is the head of the Satanic Temple. Hello.
Hello.
So I think that there's probably a lot of listeners who don't know what you do or who you are. Can you give us a few highlights that they should know about?
Yes, well, we're the Satanic Temple, and we are an atheistic religion, and we argue for non-theistic religion as a cultural identity, a narrative construct that people can latch on to and put forward their deeply held beliefs and have them legally recognized, just as any other religious agenda could possibly do. And you'll find us putting forward our own religious agenda in contradiction often to some of the conservative Christian religious agenda. And it's caused no amount of alarm, or no small amount of alarm from them. And some of our successes include having offered a monument, a satanic monument, to complement and contrast a Ten Commandments monument in Oklahoma, which we presume helped the Oklahoma Supreme Court to decide that the Oklahoman Ten Commandments monument needed to come down off the Capitol grounds. And similarly, there was an open forum in a public school in Florida that was allowing for the distribution of evangelical material, and we offered satanic material, so they shut down the entire forum. So we're kind of calling out the hypocrisy on these groups that put forward legislation or privileged activities for the evangelicals, thinking that only one religious group will benefit from the allowances they put forward. And we're showing them that once they open the door for religious proselytization in any public forum, they have to count on the Satanists coming as well.
Nice. So how does one join the Satanic Temple?
Well, there is no fee for it. We do sell a certificate and card if people want those things, and often people do. The sense of identity really means something to them. People like having those items, but you can really just sign up on the website, get our newsletter, and we consider you a member of the Satanic Temple from that point forward.
What kinds of things can members do to help the kind of work that you do?
Well, in a lot of the cases we work on, like in Oklahoma and in Florida and in other places where sometimes there's nativity scenes put up during Christmas time, we're offering satanic happy holidays during the so-called Christmas season. You need somebody of local standing to put forward that there are Satanists in the area and that there's legitimacy to having these things in their community. So when people notice these breaches of church and state and they're willing to identify with the Satanic Temple, they should reach out to us and we can help them engage in these activities in their own community.
Excellent. So where could our listeners find you on the internet if they want to get involved?
Well, we have a very active Facebook page where we put a lot of our media updates. So find the Satanic Temple on Facebook or look us up on our website, thesatanictemple.com.
And if you have any listener feedback for us, please send us an email at humanisthour@americanhumanist.org or give us a call 202-618-1371.
All right, everybody. Until next time, bye-bye.
Bye.